we're digging into some headlines from the science world with our regular science guest, Gemma Tarlak. From dining on invasive species to stopping the end of the world with a nuclear blast, we've got some interesting stories to talk about today.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She's with us every month to talk about some of the latest cool science news. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, always good to be with you guys.
So a tasty story maybe to start with, best headline, if you can't beat them, eat them. So invasive species, a new radical approach.
And a delicious one, apparently. So just a word to the listeners, if you are eating a late lunch, you might want to put the fork down, because apparently the latest thing are researchers studying invasive species by day and then eating them by night. The whole idea is not, you know, love your enemy, but actually eat your enemy. And yeah, we talked to a couple different doctoral students who came up with these recipes to basically eat their research subjects.
Apparently this has really taken off. There are recipes that you include, or at least profiles of them, pictures in the magazine, including deep-fried invasive earthworms. How does this stuff actually taste?
You know, I am quite devastated that I was never offered a taste, so I cannot comment. But apparently, you know, people ate them and lived to tell about it. One of the researchers, I love it, he says to cut the mud flour, to cut the mud flavor, he feeds the animals cornmeal before sautéing them.
That's a Chinese mystery snail fettuccine is the recipe, right?
Yes, yes. And, you know, you thought mystery meat was bad at the cafeteria. Well, here's a mystery snail for you. And you know, we didn't have room to run the recipes, but if you go to invasivore.org, you can apparently get all the delicious recipes, as well as a lot of other ideas on how to, you know, if you can't beat them, eat them when it comes to invasive species.
So are people actually doing this, or is this just kind of a lark?
No, I mean, apparently it started as a lark with, you know, researchers kind of up in the UP without anything to do and thinking, well, we got all these, you know, invasive species. How do they taste? But apparently it's really taken off. And that's not too surprising given, you know, the locavore movements and increasing interest in things like eating insects. And, you know, it does make sense on just a very logical level. It makes absolute sense. But on the other hand, I'm not going to be tucking into any mud-flavored snails anytime soon.
If this is a real problem, a lot of these invasives, if we can find some use for them, culinary or otherwise, it could give us an incentive to put a dent into some of these species that are causing so much trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know there are some places like, you know, the dreaded Asian carp. Mm-hmm. I know there are some places that are actually serving them up, or other fish that have made it into various waterways. And they're trying to get people to say, hey, you know, try this out. So it's definitely a trend. How far the trend will go, you know, if it will extend to delicious invasive earthworms, I don't know. But it's certainly a novel approach. And what I like about it is that it's kind of neutral. You know, you're not introducing another invasive species to fight the first invasive species, which has happened in the past. And it's just, you know, it's kind of a positive story out of something really destructive and kind of gross.
Well, our next story is kind of the stuff of Hollywood blockbusters, but there is a physicist living in New Mexico who spent decades studying a last resort way to save planet Earth by stopping killer asteroids. So how could we stop an asteroid that's headed straight for the planet?
Well, you know, as Bruce Willis and Aerosmith taught us, we could just kind of ram a spacecraft into an asteroid, but the physicist, John Remo, has a much more elegant solution. He wants us to launch nuclear weapons into space and then to detonate the weapons at a certain distance from the incoming asteroid. Doesn't want to destroy the asteroid, does not want to break it into a bunch of little asteroids that would all be dangerous on their own, but the idea is you detonate the nuclear weapons just close enough and just in the right spot with just enough force to nudge the asteroid out of our way. And then it could go on its merry way and, you know, destroy some other planet. But for us, we would save the planet with, you know, he says we've got the technology. We just haven't had the will to develop a cohesive policy to do it.
So how far out would we have to catch that asteroid, detect it, to be able to intercept it and nudge it out of the way with a subtle little, you know, nuclear blast?
Well, actually, he thinks, you know, we could rally and if we saw, say, 2 weeks out or 3 weeks out, that we have the technology to rally and get it done. But there are a lot of obstacles in the way right now, everything from just people not working together on this project as a whole, but also just political issues. You know, there are a lot of international treaties that say, hey, you can't put a nuclear weapon in space. And obviously you can understand a lot of reasons why you would not want to do that. But he seems to think right now, you know, if push came to shove, and we heard later today on the Central Time, you know, news break at 4 o'clock that, hey, we've got an incoming asteroid, he thinks researchers could rally if, you know, politicians gave them the license to do so.
Knocking on wood to not be jinxed there on that headline.
Yeah, right?
Well, do we know some of those hard questions, the answers to them about what a nuclear blast would do, how it would behave in outer space, and also would there be potential, you know, fallout, literally, I guess, and symbolically,
yeah,
on here on planet Earth?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is he has done just about all the experimentation he can do on the planet. In fact, he took all his research to a place called the Z Machine, which I just love the sound of. And we've got a photo, yeah, in the magazine of this crazy thing. It's in New Mexico, and it's the world's most powerful nuclear blast simulator. And they use it for all different kinds of research. But he went there, he took a bunch of different kinds of small, very small meteorites with him, and tested kind of how much force would be needed, the distance, the, you know, everything based on how big the asteroid was, what it was composed of, etc. And so he's worked out a lot of that, as much as he can do on the ground, but he really wants to try some tests in space. Hmm. And that's where he's, you know, coming into some obstacles, people saying, I don't think that's such a good idea. But his argument is, if we could identify the asteroid far enough out, we could detonate the weapon so that there would be no potential for harm to the planet.
Well, that's going to be one to watch out for. Now, I know, Gemma, you are a fan of figuring out the earliest human origins, the origins of civilization, and you're just kicking off a series in Discover called Origin Story. You start us off with funeral practices in ancient Egypt. So what is the newest high-tech stuff telling us about ancient Egypt?
Yeah, and actually, just to back up a little bit, Origin Story is our new column. And the whole idea of it is to explain where we as 21st century humans came from. So some months we're going to delve into culturally where are our roots. Sometimes it'll be looking at evolution and the earliest hominids. And sometimes it'll be a mix of both. We're kind of taking the broad look at how we came to be who we are. And we started Origin Story in March with a story about, you know, ancient Egypt is the world's first formal state, the world's first formal political state. And we know that, but we're really fuzzy on what came before it. And basically prevailing theory was, oh, it was just a bunch of hunter-gatherers, and they were kind of all sprinkled all over Egypt and Sudan, and then, poof, they became a political state. And there's been a lot of questions. How did they do it? How quickly did they do it? Evidence suggested they did it very quickly, which was kind of mysterious. So fast forward to 2014, when this University of York chemical paleochemist, he actually is, I did not know that was a thing, but it's a thing. He's a paleochemist, and he analyzed funerary textiles from a location in Egypt that was really incredibly old. The textiles were more than 3,000 years old. Some of them were almost 4,500 years old. He was able to identify in the actual textiles the residue of what they used to mummify the individuals. So not only were they mummifying the individuals, which he proved because there was a question about how early mummification started, but he found out the recipe for mummifying these individuals, you know, 4,500 years ago was the same recipe, just about, that they were using 3,000 years later at the height of mummification in the Egyptian state. And this points to Neolithic Egypt, pre-dynastic Egypt, being way more advanced and way more a cohesive society than we ever thought possible. And it's really exciting that these tiny little fragments are just completely rewriting our understanding of ancient Egypt's chronology.
Right, so does this mean that this group of hunter-gatherers were a lot more organized and advanced than we thought, and it changes the actual timeline about ancient Egyptian society and how it formed?
Yes, it does, absolutely, because, you know, they had the same recipe down, the same recipe that was used throughout Egypt, throughout the entire existence of the state. And they had that down, nailed down, 4,500 years ago. And some of the ingredients came as far away as Turkey, So that tells you they were trading for specific ingredients. They had the procedure down because some ingredients had to be heated or processed. They had the proportion of ingredients down. So they nailed it all down, which tells you they were performing empirical science that long ago, you know, more than 6,000 years ago. And at the same time, it implies that in addition to them being advanced, they were also a cohesive culture already. So whether you live kind of in the Nile Valley or out kind of in the, you know, grazing lands hundreds of miles away, you seem to share the same culture. And that's really exciting news.
Well, Gemma, interesting stuff. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing it with us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the latest science news.